The kiosk dispensing leader tags had both keyboard and voice input.
Crown and spears.
It spit a green tree-shaped tag into its output bin. Kai picked it up.
Hold pointing tree tip facing away from you.
Kai turned the tag in her hand until it pointed forward.
Turn 58 degrees right.
She almost laughed, but instead turned.
Walk ahead.
By the time she got to the Crown and Spears entrance, she was heartily tired of the tagger's voice. It didn't seem to have a volume control, so everyone nearby got to hear its fussy warnings.
Do not walk into trash bins. Turn 30 degrees right. Now, 30 degrees left.
Finally, Kai came to the entrance.
You are here. You are here. You are here. Task over. To reactivate, place in input bin of leader tag kiosk. If not returned to kiosk within 1 hour, alarm will sound.
Kai entered Crown and Spears, the familiar silver, gray, and blue decor comforting, and walked up to an elegant young man in black suit and white shirt.
May we help you?
Excuse me, where can I put this tagger thing?
Oh, we have a kiosk. Most businesses do.
He took it from her and put it in a smaller version of the kiosk she'd used, tucked between two ornamental pillars.
Now, may we help you with something else?
I'm Captain Kailara Vata. I am opening a new account here.
A moment.
His eyes blanked, then focused again.
Yes, of course. You spoke to our senior account executive before. She will be pleased to meet with you now, if that is quite convenient.
Certainly. Thank you.
Kai followed him across the dark, shining floor, past large desks, each with its attendant, and then down a carpeted hallway to a large office on the right.
Melly, this is Captain Vada. Captain Vada, Melanda Torin.
Captain Vada, what a pleasure.
The woman she'd seen on screen now looked older, less exuberant. Black suit cut to show her figure, white blouse with a frill of lace at the throat, gold earrings, a thick mop of red-brown hair, shoulder length, and startling blue eyes.
The pleasure is mine.
Our laws require that we meet new account owners in person and confirm identity. That is hard to do these days with multiple Ansible failures, but I believe we have Vada family DNA samples on file. You would not object to a comparison.
Kai had not anticipated this.
No, but doesn't that take a long time?
For a reasonably close family resemblance, no. Let's see. 2 years ago, Captain Vada came through, Josephine Iola Grace. Would you know how closely she might be related?
If she listed her father as Stavros, she was my first cousin. Her father and mine were brothers. They're all dead.
I'm surprised to hear that. She was quite young.
Her ship was blown up.
You said all dead. Do you mean your father?
Yes. Father, mother, brothers, and my uncle Stavros and much of his family. You had not heard?
I had not, no. I'm sorry, Captain Vada. I did not mean to offend.
Oh, you didn't offend. You didn't know.
Do you have no one then?
Well, some survived. Joe's sister Stella, her mother, Stavros's wife Helen. I don't know about her children.
Kai had never met Joe's children. They'd been born while she was in boarding school or the academy.
I shall hope they are safe.
I also. But I don't know. The slaughter key Ansible is down.
Grace looked out her window before dawn. She had no need to stand in front of it. She used the excellent optics she'd installed and scanned everything in view on that side of the house, methodically sweeping back and forth, working her way out from the crazy paved walk below, past the strip of grass, the roses trained against the wall itself, keying to the angle she'd arranged to see its far side, where a striped cat crouched, tail twitching, about to leap on a rabbit nibbling berries a few yards along. Beyond, a stretch of rougher grass to the perimeter fence. Another rabbit, a pair of them, frisking, courting, mating. Well, they were rabbits. She wished the cat luck. Beyond the perimeter fence, the land rose in gentle waves to the hills and the road. A bulge of hill cut off any view down valley to the east. The road curved around it.
Right about now.
The first traffic of the day, a truck whose engine had made the same squawk and growl when its driver shifted for the downgrade every morning since they'd come. It was too early for birds to show her if anyone lay hidden in the rock outcrop, now a dark blur on slightly lighter dark. Movement caught her eye. She scanned the top of the outcrop. Small, alert, but uninterested in the hollow below, ears cocked to something uphill. It stood and trailed its bushy tail over the rocks as it slid down on the riverside.
Fox, what alerted it?
Now she saw, pouring off the road in a slow torrent, a flock of sheep. Two shepherds were with them, and four dogs. Sheep and dogs passed the rock outcrop. One of the dogs leapt up to the top and sniffed, tail wagging wildly, but jumped down and went on when a shepherd called it. Without moving from her comfortable bed, Grace checked the other sides of the house. Nothing. Ponies up near the house end of the paddock, waiting for the children to run out and feed them. Their girl, Caitlin, from the town on her bicycle, leaving a dark trace in the silvery dew as she rode on the footpath instead of the road. Grace turned off her system and let herself doze as light brightened in the room. She had been up until almost four, interfering with the sleep of the wicked, making them nervous enough to call each other on what they believed were secure lines, and she knew were not. She had recordings. She had made copies. She had transmitted copies to various locations. She needed to think about what they'd said, make sense of it, make plans, but she was tired and hated the years that had stolen her ability to stay up two nights running. The cry woke her, completely alert in an instant. She was halfway across the room, weapon in hand, when she thought to grab the security system's master control and plug in her implant. The paddock. One pony down, legs thrashing. Justin, Joe's elder child, sprawled in the grass. Helen, running. The other pony standing stiff, head thrown up, ears pricked, with Char, the younger child, clinging to its mane. They weren't supposed to ride until after breakfast. It was after breakfast. She'd overslept, and Helen hadn't woken her. She threw the scans to full power. There, a glint in the briars. No time to get downstairs, outside. She was across the second-story bridge to the far side of the house, out on the balcony, peering through the exuberant flowering vine and its equally exuberant bees, when the assassin stood up to get a better shot at the other pony or its rider. Or at Helen, who was ignoring the obvious danger and running straight for the fallen child. Ignoring the bees, ignoring Helen's yells and the second pony's sudden bolt, Grace focused her whole attention on drilling a hole through the assassin. He fell. Grace scanned the area again for any other threat.
A lone assassin?
Stupid of them, and Grace wasn't sure she believed it. Movement in a neighboring field caught her eye. A rabbit, streaking away from where it had been quietly nibbling grass. Her gaze tracked the streak back, back, to another tangle of briars. There. Her vision, aided by highly illicit processors in her implant, she detected heat radiation. And there, aided again by other highly illicit bioelectronics, she directed her next shot. Helen had reached Justin, thrown herself over him as a protective blanket.
For all the good that will do, stay down, Helen.
The second pony had slowed from its wild bolt. The child still hugged its neck, unhurt, mouth a round O, eyes wide. The pony flicked its ears back and forth, then suddenly lowered its head to snatch grass. The child slithered off, unbalanced by that move. Unhurt, apparently, Char threw a leg over the pony's neck and tugged at its mane, trying the trick they'd taught the pony 2 weeks before, to raise its head and lift a child rider to its back. Grace didn't want to leave the window, where she had the best view, but she had to. She was still wearing her night clothes, a close-fitting black garment with pad-protected elbows and knees in which she'd climbed out of her own window at midnight and back into it at 4 a.m. When she went downstairs, Caitlin saw her and froze, fist to her mouth. Grace thought of what Caitlin was seeing, a slim black figure holding a very nasty-looking weapon. One of them.
It's all right, Caitlin. It's just me.
But, Miss Grace...
Caitlin, go in the kitchen and stay there.
The police...
Don't call them. I will or Helen will.
The doctor?
One of us will call if a doctor's needed. Stay in the kitchen until you're called. Can you do that?
A nod from Caitlin, still paler than she should have been. Grace moved to the back of the house. The garden, from above, had an obvious plan, but from the ground presented too many obstructions and distractions. She wanted to hurry. She might be needed now. But hurry brought her too predictably to walks and open spaces easy to range. They, if any such were still out there, would expect the hurry, the predictable direct approach through the main aisle in this garden, wide enough for a small tractor and its implements. Grace chose a slower route, but not much slower for someone who had prepared carefully, for whom the straight lines of apparently solid walls and hedges had gaps ready for use by those who knew them. She knew them all. Now she came to the paddock, where the injured pony's leg was gone, ending in a mangled stump still spurting blood. The other legs kicked less vigorously. She should kill the pony humanely, but she had humans to check on.
Helen, how bad is it?
Not hurt, just stunned. Char?
Stunned could kill, as they both knew.
Char's fine.
Down the paddock, Char was back astride the second pony, kicking hard, but the pony didn't want to approach.
Are they coming?
Not those two. I'll get Char.
I meant the police.
Not for a while. Not until after we call them, so don't.
Don't call?
No.
Grace walked up to the first pony, whose glazing eyes barely turned to see her, squatted down, and aimed carefully at the crossing of the X made by lines from right ear to left eye and left ear to right eye.
Sorry.
The pony jerked and then went limp.
What did you do?
Gave it peace. Get Justin inside if you can. I'll get Char.
She walked down the paddock, itchy with tension, an easy target, to the far corner, where the second pony was grazing in quick, nervous snatches. Char, sitting bolt upright on the pony's back, stared at Grace as if she were a stranger. Perhaps the child didn't recognize her. She herself felt more at home than she had in decades, the carefully constructed veneer of slightly batty and prudish old lady falling away to reveal the same familiar interior Grace, a Grace perfectly at home in black climbing suit with a weapon in hand.
Easy now, Buttercup. Char, your mother wants you. It's time to go in.
He won't go!
Char looked so much like Joe at that age that Grace almost choked.
He's scared. You sound a little scared, too.
What happened to Rosie? Did you shoot Rosie?
Rosie broke a leg. It was a bad break. It couldn't be fixed. Come down now.
Grace started to reach for Char, but the pony sidestepped, and she had only one hand, the other being still occupied with her weapon. Char had tilted toward her and now slid too far off balance. Something slammed into Grace's left arm, whirling her around as if in a dance. She fell, knowing instantly that there had been more than two. She was on the ground. Char, face down and head up, stared at her.
Stay down, Char. Stay flat and be quiet, and hold still no matter what.
Waves of pain washed over her. Nausea racked her. She turned her head and saw, without surprise, that her arm was lying folded up all wrong in a widening pool of blood.
Oh, damn!
Bad word! Grandma says...
Quiet! You be the baby possum, like in the story.
Grace had to do something about the bleeding or she would be dead, like the daddy possum in the story. But that would mean letting go of her weapon, something she was sure the assassin would like to see. She willed herself to stay conscious until she could shoot the scum sucker in the gut. There was the dark shape, in a suit similar to her own, but with a hood and mask. She struggled to bring her weapon to bear. And then the figure staggered, fell face down, and behind it was someone she recognized too slowly as MacRobert, bloody fish-gutting knife in hand.
You!
You're having an interesting morning.
He moved up beside her, grabbed her left arm, and shoved what felt like a spear into the bone. She knew it was his thumb on the artery, but that's not what it felt like.
I got two of them.
Grace wondered why she was justifying herself to him.
That's good, because I don't think I could sneak up on any more that way. May I take your weapon if I need it?
Go ahead.
I heard their shots, but no answering fire. Took me a while to make it from the river.
Grace's vision was going. She was peering down a dark tunnel at a small, bright image.
I'm glad you did.
Stay with me now. Come on.
She felt his hand at her mouth. a tiny hard something on her tongue that tasted bitter.
Bite that.
She bit. She had tasted it before, and military-grade stim tabs hadn't changed that much. The tunnel shortened, then disappeared. She saw very clearly, with little bright halos around everything.
You may lose this arm.
I thought so.
Aunt Grace?
This is a friend, Char.
Or maybe not, but Grace could not at the moment cope with the possibility that he was one of them.
Can I get up?
No, not yet. You just lie quiet and let me help your Aunt Grace.
He had placed a tourniquet now, doing it one-handed with a deftness that indicated he'd done it before. Grace thought of offering to replace his thumb with her right hand for arterial pressure, then, as another wave of nausea hit her, decided to just lie there and let him work. The stim tab and her own biochemistry finally reached equilibrium about the time he had the tourniquet tightened and started to straighten her arm out. She rolled her head to see.
You better not look.
She looked anyway, a mangled mess where her elbow had been, only a shred of skin holding it on. Beyond, her undamaged left hand, now looking like the corpse it was, bloodless.
Might as well take it off the whole way.
I am no surgeon.
It's not an arm at this point.
Grace felt only mild regret, which she knew to be shock and drug combined. Still, two live children for one lost arm was a good bargain.
As you wish.
He cleaned the gutting knife carefully, something she appreciated fully only later, and cut the arm free. Grace felt nothing physical, but despite her determination to accept the loss, there was something profoundly wrong about her arm. Her arm, lying there with no connection to her. It was not her arm. It could not be her arm. It must be someone else's arm. What a disgusting thing to leave lying in the paddock where a child might see it. She had a dim memory of MacRobert helping her back to the house, of his voice assuring her the children were safe, Helen was safe. Everyone was safe. When she opened her eyes to find herself in bed, floating above the mattress in a pink cloud. That was so unlikely that she closed her eyes again, willing herself to dream properly and wake up completely. On the second try, she recognized the drifting sensation as drug-induced, and the memory of the morning's... that morning's? Events appeared in chunks, accessed by her implant's recording.
Transfer to Regional Trauma Center immediately.
Grace wanted to argue, but her mouth was full of very dry cotton.
I should have called immediately.
She said...
She said? Why would you listen to a woman missing an arm? A woman in shock? People in shock say all sorts of stupid things.
Grace felt anger stirring. Her tongue was working its way through the cotton.
Not stupid!
Even to herself, it sounded more like a frog than a human. A stranger's face appeared on one side, Helen's on the other.
Grace, you're awake!
Not really awake, she wanted to say. Too full of drugs to be really awake. But the other face annoyed her, as full of self-righteousness and scorn as the voice had been.
Who you?
I'm the local doctor. Please stay calm. You've had a rather serious injury. Some kind of hunting accident. Oh, these idiots, summer visitors, never seem to think about how far their shots go. Mr. Rabbit, I dare say.
And he had called her stupid. Three hunters shooting at and missing three rabbits?
Where, Mac?
The man? The fisherman who helped you? He's gone to help the police find the hunters.
So there was a reason for the stupidity about hunters. Grace wished she could think what it was. The ceiling of the Regional Trauma Center's amputation ward had been designed for the entertainment of those who must lie flat in bed. Grace had a choice of programs to display: games, news, sports. None of them served her purpose. She had been overruled by doctors, psychologists, and worst of all, Helen. All of them certain that a woman her age needed the specialized services here, rather than specialists in attendance there.
It's
Surreptitiously, she hitched herself up in the bed until she could use the headboard to tilt her head forward and look across the room. Through the glass sliding door, she could see the man in uniform seated just beside it. The Careless Hunter story had broken down. Provincial authorities knew that the shots had been attempted murders. Her life, they said, might be in danger. They were not happy with her weapon, though she faced no charges for having wounded, unhappily not killed, the assailants. An unlicensed beam weapon was an indictable offense, she'd been told. Hadn't she realized? Her explanations had been received in silence, without comment afterward. Her stump ached. No, calling it an ache was a euphemism. The attendants used euphemisms.
Are we feeling some discomfort, dear?
It wasn't discomfort, and it wasn't an ache. It hurt. A lot. The med dispenser button lay just under her right index finger. She didn't push it. No one died of pain, and she wanted to think. They had cleaned up the stump of her arm. The bulky wrappings prodded her ribs. She wanted a cloned prosthesis. They were saying she was too old, and she needed a way to convince them she wasn't. Using heels, hips, and her right arm, she pushed herself headward a few more centimeters. It was never good to lie still too long. She couldn't turn on her side. The arm board and IV line to her right arm made it too awkward, and she wasn't about to try lying on her stump. But by the clock, she had 18 minutes until the next official attendant check. The man outside the door alerted. She saw his head come up, his arm drop to his side. Her chest tightened. Then he relaxed, smiled, stood up. Helen already? She wasn't supposed to visit until tomorrow. Grace made herself breathe more slowly. No use panicking the attendants. MacRobert peered through the door, winked at her, said something to the man in uniform, then came in. He had a sheaf of flowers wrapped in green paper.
You're looking better?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
He looked around for somewhere to put the flowers and chose the pitcher from the bedside table.
Just a moment.
He took the pitcher and flowers into the tiny adjoining bathroom, to which Grace had not yet been allowed access, and came back with them.
There. Nothing makes a hospital room really cheerful, but flowers can't hurt.
They're lovely.
Grace did not believe for a moment that he had brought her flowers just to cheer her up. But as long as she was stuck in a ward with full patient monitoring, she could think of no other way to communicate. He gave her a sweet smile, something so at odds with what she thought of him that she felt herself scowling back.
Are you in pain? You're frowning. I was due extra leave and it was granted, so I thought I'd stay in the area until you're out of the hospital. My time's up in the cottage, but your niece, is it? Graciously invited me to stay at the manor with her and the children. I offered to do the back and forth for her. The children are upset about the pony.
That's very nice of her, of you. Of course, we do have fishing rights to that whole area. I hope you're scaring some fish.
He pulled one of the chairs around to sit facing her.
A few, yes. Wouldn't you like the bed elevated?
I would, yes, but they wouldn't. And the bed reports to the nursing station if I do it. In would come the efficient attendants to put it back down and remind me not to hit that button by accident.
Oh, control enthusiasts, aren't they? Helen says they're bucking about a cloned prosthesis instead of a bioelectronic.
They think the clone won't take, or it's not cost-effective or something.
How long does it take?
To grow an arm? Minimum of 8 months. 4 for the initial stage, then implantation, then another 4 to 8 of boosted growth and a lot of physical therapy. And I resent every day of it. I knew there was more than one. I knew there might be more than two. But I had to go get Shaw.
Of course you did. The bioelectronic prosthesis is faster, though, isn't it?
Supposedly, yes. Hook up the nerves, attach the prosthesis, and then it's 40 to 60 days of training. But it wouldn't be my arm.
Oh, they could make it look like...
I don't care about looks. I care about function. It's easier to interfere with the signaling in a non-cloned prosthesis. It's less reliable. I can't afford to worry about who might be programming my arm.
Oh.
Bad enough I'm out of action when Helen needs me.
A shorter time out would seem better, except I don't know when or who or how many.
Well, perhaps you could recuperate back at the manor while you're making that decision.
Get out of here? Everyone seems convinced I need to be here.
Until you are out of danger, yes. But now, don't you have some recovery time before they can start either approach to a prosthesis?
I think so, yes.
Well, you'd be as safe from a security standpoint at the house as here. The level of medical support you need is much less now. Last time I stopped by, you had tubes and wires everywhere.
I don't remember.
Yeah, blood loss and shock. You made a remarkable recovery.
He did not add, for a woman your age, which the attendants kept mentioning. She felt absurdly grateful.
I intend to make a full recovery. I have things to do.
One of the most frustrating things about being locked up here was having to leave the guilty at peace.
I'm sure you do. But if you feel up to roughing it in the country, we can both put pressure on the staff.
Just a moment.
Grace felt around on the keypad under her right hand. The head of the bed came up. She didn't feel at all dizzy.
It's hard to argue effectively while you're flat on your back.
Indeed. Shall I barricade the door so the attendants can't get in, or...
No, you're going to help me get out of bed and into the bathroom.
I am?
You are. Here, give me your arm.
He held out his bent arm. She grabbed it and pulled herself upright. Now she was dizzy for a moment, but it passed. Sitting upright on the side of the bed felt much better than lying in it. Her bare feet, hanging over the side of the bed, looked pale and oddly unnatural.
I'm going to stand. I'll have to lug this damned IV pole with me.
You sure? Oh, never mind. You're always sure.
MacRobert positioned himself to make it easy for her to slide off the bed, his other arm ready to steady her if she needed it. She felt lopsided without her left arm, but not unsteady. He put a firm hand on her back as she reached out to the IV pole, and together they started a very slow walk across the room. They were halfway to the bathroom when an attendant came bustling in.
Now, dear, mustn't play with the bed control. What do you think you're doing? You, whoever you are, get away from her!
No, I need his help. I'm going to the bathroom.
You can't!
I most certainly can, and I most certainly am. It's a shame that this gentleman is more used to me than you are, but it can't be helped. I certainly wasn't going to use a bedpan in front of him.
You should have rung.
You should quit treating me like an idiot. If you want to help, unhook me from this blasted pole, or help me bring it along.
I'll have to call the doctor.
And I have to use the toilet. Are you going to help or not?
The longer she stood up, the more Grace wondered if this had been a good idea, and she really did need to get to the bathroom. The attendant finally reached for the pole. Grace transferred her grip to MacRobert's arm and took another step. The attendant didn't want to leave her alone in the bathroom, but MacRobert drew her away and shut the door. Grace sat, feeling limper than she liked, but also triumphant. She imagined pacifying pharmaceuticals rushing away, and when she was through, she stood up by herself with a good grip on the IV pole. That brought her face to face with the mirror. The person staring back at her was only partially familiar. It wasn't the missing arm that bothered her, but the stooped posture and slack, puffy face with the hazed eyes. She dismissed the ridiculous hospital gown as an irrelevant accident. She forced herself upright. Better. Glared at the puffy face. Better again. Made faces at herself in the mirror. On her way back to the bed, which seemed much farther away than it had been on the way to the toilet, she looked at the attendant.
I'm going home tomorrow.
You can't!
Grace sat down on the bed, trembling with exhaustion.
By law, I certainly can. I am a competent adult and thus allowed to discharge myself from a medical facility at any time, whether or not it imperils my life. And since I am a competent adult, this won't. I will have medical assistance at home.
But
you really do not want a legal battle with me.
She's right.
The attendant looked at MacRobert, then back at Grace.
I'll have to talk to the doctor.
The attendant left in a hurry.
Idiot.
Grace was perched on the edge of her bed and had no idea how to lie down again without hitting her stump. It hurt enough already. She did not want to bang it on anything.
Here.
MacRobert put one arm behind her and presented the other for her to hold with her good hand. She would have glared at him, except that he was doing the obvious best thing, without fuss. She let him ease her back to the bed, but managed to get her legs up onto it before he reached for them. He laid the cover over her lightly.
You really are one to take an idea and run with it, aren't you? When I suggested recuperating back at the manor, I wasn't thinking of tomorrow.
I'll rest better. And I'll be there if...
If nothing, I'm there. You're not in action right now. But you're a very determined woman.
Grace arrived back at the manor in a medical transport, clearly marked as such. This obvious signal to the other side that she was helpless infuriated her, but the medical staff had insisted that she could not travel safely without attendants, and Helen backed them up. She was tense all the way, feeling like an obvious target, but the trip went without incident. Perhaps MacRobert had arranged protection. She felt inclined to believe that he had. She let herself be moved through the house in a hover chair, vowing silently that she would be on her feet as soon as she got rid of the warriors. She wanted to see the children above all, but Helen was worried that they'd upset her.
Auntie Grace?
Yes, Shaw.
Grandma said it's a bad word, but sometimes it's all right for grown-ups to say bad words.
Excuse me? What, Shaw?
That word you said when you fell down and there was all that blood. I told Grandma you said it, and then your arm fell off and there was all that blood. I thought it made your arm fall off to say the bad word, but Grandma said no.
The pure absurdity of that brought tears to her eyes. Char looked at her with concern. Grace blinked the tears away.
Oh, Char. I'm sorry. I'm fine, but that just hit me funny.
You cry when something's funny?
Sometimes. Char, you did very well that day.
It was scary. Buttercup bucked me off twice, and Justin was laying there, and Grandma was screaming, and you...
Yes, it was scary, but you did very well. You did what I told you. You didn't scream.
I wanted to.
But you didn't. Do you still need to scream?
Char looked down.
Sometimes, but it's bad. It upsets Grandma.
Not at the right times. When something's been really scary and you couldn't scream then, sometimes you need to scream or cry later.
Really?
Oh, yes. Sometimes I scream.
Char smiled through tears and then left. Grace wondered when MacRobert would show up. Soon, she hoped. Her next visitor, however, was Helen, who shut the door behind her and stood by it.
I... haven't thanked you yet for saving the children.
Helen, say what you mean.
It's... I can't.
Helen, always so remote and cool, collapsed on the chair suddenly, shoulders shaking. Grace cursed her own weakness.
Stav and Joe and the children almost...
But they didn't get the children.
But they almost did. If you hadn't been there...
If I hadn't overslept... I'd have known they were there before the children went out. How's Justin?
Oh, he's fine. A bump on the head, that's all. He's upset about Rosie, of course. I've got to stop this... all this crying.
You have a lot to cry about. So do the children.
You aren't crying, and you're the one who lost an arm.
But not a husband and children. Can we stop this comparison of grief? I certainly don't think less of you for grieving.
Oh, yes. It just hits me at the oddest moments, and I did want to thank you.
You're welcome. Now, what happened to the assassins?
I don't know. The police kept telling me to take care of the children and not to worry when I asked. They took your weapon away, I do know that.
Just the one I had with me?
You have others? here?
I certainly hope so. Not that I'm in shape to use them, but I'd hate to lose them. Any more trouble?
No, nothing. The police have been here, of course, and that fisherman who knew you, McRobert.
You meet the nicest people on the river. Quite the gentleman he is.
You did know he's in Space Force.
Is he?
Grace, don't do that. I know you knew. You know everything about everyone 5 minutes before you meet them.
Do I? All right. I knew McRobert was in Space Force. I did check out who was renting cabins on the river when we leased this place. That was an obvious way for someone to gain access. But when we met on the river, he was all right. I watched for a few days to see. He's a wet fly fisherman, and he was fishing like any other.
It was hours later, while she was napping, that McRobert came. He looked around the room in a way that indicated the locations of system elements.
You have a nice system here.
Thank you. Now, why were you so anxious to get me out of that hospital?
Events. Would you like to check your system and see that it's functioning?
Yes.
Grace accessed her implant security subroutines linked into the house system. All well so far.
If you'll hand me the controller in the drawer of the bedside table?
It looked like the remote for a vid screen. McRobert handed it to her. She ran through the diagnostics, something the implant could not do without a direct physical access. All correct. The system was on at the highest level, as it should be.
Clear.
McRobert sat down in the chair near the bed.
Good. You had obtained information on the actions of officials in high office. You had transmitted that information to certain persons, am I right?
Yes.
I would like to see that information. We're concerned that those persons are not the ideal agents in this instance.
We?
We have a common cause. We have a common enemy.
Do we?
Yes. Whoever attacked Vada did so not just to destroy Vada, but to terrify the government. And my best guess is not this government alone. It would not surprise me to find that other Ansibles than ours are out of commission and that atrocities have been committed in other systems, all to cause governments to weaken or fall. Here in the one system where we can obtain hard data, we know that the highest level of the government is involved.
Who are we?
What Grace really wanted to ask was, who are you? But the answer to the other might make that clear enough.
Space Force is tasked with external security issues. That's public knowledge. We were deliberately misled and kept from knowing things that then allowed the transfer of weaponry from a non-allied space fleet to this planet, and activation of that weaponry by at least one such ship. The attack on Corley Island's Vada offices and household was made using high-level weaponry controlled from space. By the time we could ascertain that, the ship involved was beyond our borders, and we were ordered not to pursue it. Then the Ansibles went out, and we were ordered to contract our perimeter to 2 light minutes.
He paused. Grace nodded her understanding.
This caused us some concern, us being that part of Space Force tasked with security analysis.
I see.
Oh, no, not completely, you don't, and I'm not authorized to share all our sources with you. Though I believe we share some sources of which we are not aware. At any rate, though my nominal position is senior NCO in the cadet barracks at Space Force Academy, my actual job is, as you've surmised, in the security sector. It's just that I could learn things fairly easily from homesick cadets that other operatives had to dig for.
So what is it you want from me?
I want you to share what you've learned with me, and let us use that information to take down the president. You've set the wrong kind of hounds on his trail. Kill him your way, and he'll be a martyr.
I want him dead.
Quite so.
Grace noted that he showed no shock or disapproval. That surprised her. He was developing a habit of surprising her, and she surprised herself by not resenting it.
And we want him discredited. If you didn't want that too, why collect the chain of evidence you've spent so much time on? We can accomplish both if we work together.
I would have to trust you.
To his credit, he didn't use, "I saved your life," to persuade her, but just sat there waiting. She closed her eyes. She wanted to trust him. She wanted nothing more than she wanted the president both dead and dishonored. But she wasn't sure even Space Force could accomplish that, or if they would. She opened her eyes.
Do I have your word, McRobert, whatever your rank really is, That you will not let that weasel escape?
Yes. And I can have a high-ranking officer come here and speak with you if that will help.
Admirals and generals are featherweights, McRobert. You, I choose to trust. All right. I'll need to get downstairs to the library and onto my secure line. What time is it? Damn. Better get me downstairs now.
She was sweating with pain, her hand and feet cold. By the time he had her installed in the chair and helped her hook up the external communications she'd established. With exquisite courtesy, he withdrew to the library proper while she sent out the coded message that meant stop, cease, await next orders. Confirmation took hours, hours during which she passed from merely tired to utterly exhausted, fighting off the pain and weakness to stay upright in her seat, acknowledging each reply within the appropriate time frame, each having its own unique reply code. At last it was done. MacRobert got her back upstairs and into bed.
You had better get it done, or I'll come after you.
I believe it, but I promise we'll get it done.
The president yawned as he sat behind his polished desk. Though he had slept better the past dozen nights, he still could not stop yawning. On his desk was the order of rescission that would invalidate all Slaughter Key letters of marque and order all its privateers to cease operations. It seemed futile, since they had no functional system Ansible and thus could not recall the privateers now in operation, but he hoped it would placate the pirate horde. At least, with that old woman out of commission, he had only one enemy to fear. His door opened unexpectedly. He glanced up to see his personal assistant, and behind him, someone in uniform.
Mr. President, the Commandant of the Space Force Academy.
The president looked up into the steady gaze of a man he had despised for decades. His assistant backed out and shut the door.
Commandant, what brings you here so...
Without an appointment? That?
The Commandant nodded at the president's desk.
Excuse me?
Mr. President, let's not play games. You're proposing... No, you've decided to rescind all letters of marque without the advice or approval of counsel. You are on the point of signing the order of rescission.
How do you know that? Have you been spying on me?
The Commandant sat without being invited to sit.
Don't be naive. Everyone spies on everyone else. It's why we have security systems.
He put a scrambler cylinder on the desk and thumbed its controls.
Someone may be able to penetrate even this, but it will take skill. Mr. President, we at Space Force, since we are tasked with the external defense of this system, have been looking into the attacks on the Vata family compound and headquarters.
Sweat sprang out on the president's back.
There's no way Space Force could know. That's not external.
In origin, yes, they were. And they represented a clear threat to our system integrity, so they are well within our defined mission.
What has this to do with the Academy? You're head of the Academy, not all of Space Force.
True. You appointed Kerr Tleeby, the Space Force Commandant, didn't you?
It was a matter of record. They both knew it.
Yes, I did. What of it?
A distinguished officer with a fine record. Would it surprise you to know that he had a history of offering and accepting bribes?
The president knew his own face was shiny with nervous sweat, but he dared not wipe it away.
I would not believe it. It's a politically motivated attack on an honorable man.
Hardly that. He's confessed, you know. Bribery, extortion, and collusion with an external enemy.
The president felt faint. Tleeby was a gruff, hearty man who had always been the most accessible, most affable military man he'd ever known.
And I must mention, Mr. President, that he has... I'm most sorry to have to say this... named you as one of the people with whom he had illicit monetary arrangements. Given his record, we do not accept this on his word alone, of course. But I'm afraid that there must be an investigation.
How did she do this?
She...
In that one word, was all the warning the president needed to pull himself back to his usual control.
Never mind. Needless to say, I repudiate everything you said. I don't know by what means you forced an innocent man to confess to crimes he had not committed, but I refuse to believe that Tleeby has done anything that heinous. And obviously I'm denying any such acts on my own part.
I understand, Mr. President.
And now I must ask you to leave. I'm quite busy already, and I will consult with my legal staff at once about this disgusting matter.
No, I'm not leaving.
Oh, but you...
The president stabbed at the emergency button on his chair.
Mr. President, for the moment, you are cut off from communication. The council are considering what to do, and I am here to ensure that you communicate with no one and take no actions related to your presidency.
How dare you!
On orders from the council, Mr. President. They have been apprised of the relevant facts, and it was their request, no, command, that you be guarded by a high-ranking officer of Space Force who was already in possession of the same facts. Sir, I would not reach into that drawer if I were you.
The president removed his hand from the drawer in which he kept his personal weapon.
You are wrong. You are completely wrong, and I will be exonerated in court. After which, your career will be in ruins.
The commandant's shoulders moved in a twitch that was not quite a shrug.
It is the risk one takes in the military. Doing the right thing has its risks, and we accept them.
I could have killed you.
The commandant smiled, not the easy, affable smile that the president had enjoyed from Tleeby, but a smile that brought ice to his heart.
I doubt it.
I want to know...
I'm sure you have many questions, Mr. President, but I'm not allowed to answer them.
This is outrageous!
Except with this.
The commandant removed from his tunic a small, round container. He opened the container and set it on the president's desk within his reach. It looked like... it was... a small pillbox. Inside was one small white pill. The president felt his insides twist into a hard knot of terror. It could not be. It could not be anything else.
Such behavior would, unfortunately, deprive us of the information you have that is relevant to your case. I would be censured severely for not anticipating such an act on your part and preventing it. On the other hand, from the perspective of the person facing intense interrogation with regard to the alleged acts of malfeasance and treason, it might be preferable. Though, of course, it would be seen as an admission of guilt.
The small white pill seemed to swell, blotting out the future. The president's mouth filled for an instant with sour liquid.
Is it painless?
No, but it is quick.
A wailing voice in his mind insisted that he had not been a bad president. He had not done anything everyone else hadn't done. At least not until the threat that could have doomed his government. We have targeted you and your family too. And he could have done nothing else then. No one could. The government needed him. Needed his familiar face and voice to reassure them through the crisis.
If one family has to suffer unfairly for it, if it is unfair for one family to suffer, then for the good of all.
The commandant's gaze ripped through that reverie. The man had a drooping eyelid as if he were going to sleep, but even so, the intense scrutiny was like a searchlight. The president knew that this man would not listen, and if he listened, would not agree with that whining voice.
You... think I should?
I have no opinion. Or rather, I have an opinion, but it would not be appropriate to state it.
I need time to think.
The commandant glanced at the clock on the wall.
Do you? That might be unfortunate.
You could have said it was painless.
I don't lie.
Other men had said that, and other men had been lying when they said it. The president had long experience of liars, great and small. But this time, with this man, habitual honesty was as obvious as habitual dishonesty was in others. It was not a boast. It was not an attempt to convince. It was a simple fact. He did not lie.
Damn the man.
The president felt the sting of tears and closed his eyes. He would not cry in front of this man. He would not beg for mercy where no mercy existed. His eyes dried, burned with the effort not to cry. His hands twitched against each other under the desk, but he was sure the Commandant knew that, even if he could not see it.
My wife. She is certainly not involved in any of the alleged incidents.
No one, Mr. President, suspects your wife of anything.
And I categorically deny that I myself have done anything illegal or improper.
I understand, Mr. President.
Whatever evidence you or the Council think they have seen, it is all faked. A malicious plot against me.
I understand, Mr. President. Time is passing, Mr. President.
Somewhere outside his office, men were searching through files and closets, questioning clerks and secretaries, housekeepers and cooks. The quick imagination that had made him so effective a politician, so able to see others' viewpoints and how to circumvent them, what means would work with which opponent, now provided a stream of images. Employees backed into corners of an office, eyes wide, muttering to each other. Families disturbed at breakfast, on vacations, children crying, spouses indignant and frightened. The incredible mess left behind any official search. The pill in its box seemed to pulsate in time with these images, alluring and terrifying all at once. He had always considered himself a brave man.
What would a brave man do?
He wanted to ask how much it hurt, how bad was the pain. But even in the roil of emotions, he knew that the Commandant could not answer that question. If it was really that, really death in that small compass, no one had lived to say how bad it was or how quick. He had never considered himself indecisive. He had always been firm in his opinions, in his positions, unswayed by anything but the practicalities of his office. Yet now he was wavering, hating himself for that wavering. In a flash, without really thinking, he grabbed the pill box, shook the pill into his hand, then into his mouth. The pill dissolved, a bitter taste, and a second later, pain wrenched his body, outlining his bones in white fire.
Good for you.
For an instant, he was grateful for that small commendation. Then the pain went beyond bearing, and he lost himself in that chaos.
Vada's War, Engaging the Enemy, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2006, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Lily Beacom, Christopher Sheeran, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Mort Shelby, Jeff Baker, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Christopher Grayville, Richard Rowan, Tim Getman, Barbara Pinolini, Terrence Aselford, Michael Glenn, Andy Clements, Eric Messner, Yasmin Toison, Dylan Lynch, Sherry Simpson, James Lewis, Thomas Penny, Laura Quinn Anderson, Katie Foster, Danny Gavigan, Joe Brack, James Konacek, Johan Detweiler, and Nathaniel Perry. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Vada's War, be sure to look for The Serrano Legacy and Rogue Angel, available at roadstops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midas, and you, Chieftain Bruinhelda, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth, in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills, and the test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, Elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Tuelalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the folk of God? But you're just a pack of scared dogs, y'all!
Join with us before all the world is fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth, and we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangair will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangair and all the masters of St. Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhoke, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in graphic audio. Don't miss Mortalis Part 2. Available now.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.